There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to The Broad Experience, the show about women, the workplace and success. I'm Ashley Milne-Tight. This time, when you're doing your job a long way from home, culture clash is almost inevitable. But in disaster zones, in developing countries,
you have to go into that and act as a woman. You know, in many cases, act as a manager in situations or cultures where that's really very rare or completely unheard of.
Which can be uncomfortable for both parties. A lot of us donate to charities or non-profits, depending which causes you care about. Some of that money probably goes to a group like Oxfam or Doctors Without Borders, an NGO that helps people in desperate situations, usually abroad. But how often do any of us think about the workers in those organisations, the people who work in the refugee camps or help get fresh water to remote communities? If I ever hear the words aid worker on the news, it's usually because one of them has been kidnapped or killed on the job. Aid work, like other helping professions, is female-dominated. And a couple of months ago, I heard from one of these women. She's a listener, and she said, you know, we hear a lot about women CEOs. We even hear about women in the military, but we never hear about women in aid, and there is a lot to talk about. We're not using her real name because she doesn't want to hurt her chances of landing her next job.
I'm Jessica, and I'm an aid worker. So I work in humanitarian response, which kind of means working in emergency situations.
Jessica's 28 now. She started her career in South Sudan, working with displaced people. Then after a few years, she went on to Jordan, then back to South Sudan, then to Sierra Leone. Sometimes the work can be dangerous. She has hidden in a bunker for hours while under bombardment. Sometimes it's more pedestrian.
In Sierra Leone, I was distributing hygiene kits to schools, going to rural villages and trying to organise how is this going to work in terms of the cars and what we put in there and on what days you do what.
When we spoke, she was on a break in London between contracts. She says that's how it works for most aid workers who go abroad for their jobs. You're gone for 6 or 9 months, the work is intense, then you go back home to flop for a while before starting a new gig.
When I come back to London and I'm there for 2 weeks, what I want to do is eat a lot of cheese and lie down and see my friends and watch a lot of Netflix.
But this time she's taking a longer break. She's thinking hard about what to do next because she says one of the tough things about this work is the utter lack of work-life balance.
When I first entered the sector and I was very, you know, naive and it was my first ever proper job and I'd just come to South Sudan and it was 2 days after independence and it was all very exciting. And I had dinner with this woman in her late 40s who basically sat me down and said, you be careful entering into this sector because what happens to a lot of women is that they have a lot of fun and then when they hit their mid-30s, they realise that they don't have a husband or any children or any stability and then they want it and by that time it's too late for them to get it because all the men working in the sector are dating younger women. And I'm not saying that that's, you know, obviously that's a generalisation and some people don't do that, but that is definitely a feeling and I am aware that there are a lot of women who are older than me who've been in the sector for longer who do feel that it's challenging and maybe have enjoyed their, like, some aspects of their lifestyle, but also feel that there was a cost.
Jessica says because of that conversation, she's been thinking about her priorities from the get-go. She says she's turned down jobs because she's put her relationship first.
Trying to have a relationship, even when you both work within this sector, can be quite difficult, particularly at the beginning, where maybe you have fewer job opportunities available to you.
She's been in a relationship for 3 years, and in all that time, they've lived in the same place for a whopping 2 months. She says she's back in London now in part because that's where her partner is at the moment and she decided she had to give things a chance.
you know, of course you get regular holidays, but it's not like a long distance relationship where you can kind of drive for 3 hours or 4 hours to go see someone. It's one where, you know, you need to take a UN helicopter to go to the place where they are. It's not really something that you can kind of just do on the spur of the moment or regularly. So I just kind of felt, you know, if I want to continue this and not just have a relationship via Skype and via Skype chat, because often the internet isn't good enough to support video, then I need to, you know, really consider what I want to do. And I think a lot of people, you see that they'll have a relationship with someone in a certain location, and then when one or the other leaves, they will end up breaking up. Not all of them. And, you know, some people then do manage to go to the next location and find jobs in similar locations. I mean, of course, for people who are not straight cisgender people, it's much more complicated, because also you may be working in countries, for example, where, you know, being homosexual is illegal. And I think that's also something that a lot of people struggle with. A lot of organisations struggle with how to deal with that. I've known people who have felt that they have to hide that for security reasons. I've known lots of colleagues who are gay, and I haven't come across any trans people or anything like that. And I think it's because it must be very challenging for them. But my colleagues who are gay, I mean, they're fine and they, you know, they deal with it. But it is more challenging for them. And there's also kind of, I think, confusion to an extent about how much of it is a personal issue and how much of it is a work issue, because in those situations, then it also can potentially bring negative things against the organisation itself, etc. It's a very thorny issue, and I think one that the sector is trying to address, but that there's definitely still a lot more work to be done on that.
What she has to contend with on a personal level is much more benign. It's just this question of how are they going to make things work long term, let alone with children, given the distances involved and the work they do. She says it's not just her who's doing the thinking.
We sat down and each wrote the top 10 countries that we would be interested in working in, and then got together and looked and kind of saw which ones overlapped. And we've done this a couple of times, but it does look like a very strange list. So at the moment, that list is Afghanistan is on there. Nigeria is on there. Any of the countries involved in the Burundi crisis, so both Burundi and any of the surrounding countries where they have refugees at the moment. Myanmar, Iraq, Pakistan, and Central African Republic and DRC.
The Democratic Republic of Congo.
Which I think is perhaps not where most people might think about kind of setting up a love nest together.
But she says those places, that's where the two of them both have an interest and where they're likely to get jobs they're both qualified for. Given how demanding the work can be, I wanted to know what she loved about it.
I mean, it's very complicated. Obviously, I'm doing it because I think that, you know, I have a desire to help and I think that the work I do is useful and it makes a difference. I'm very aware that it's also very complicated and that there's a lot of issues going on there, and that it's not as simple as me going and helping people. But also, you know, I like the adventure. I like meeting people from new countries. I like being thrown into the middle of very difficult circumstances and always having the kind of adrenaline of changing situations and having to adapt to that.
London can feel quite sedate by comparison. So as she says, she likes the difficultness of her job in many ways. But one of the things she mentioned when she first emailed me was what a big problem sexual assault and sexual harassment are in the aid world. Jessica says the worst thing that's happened to her is a wildly inappropriate comment. But she says talk to female aid workers and many of them have horror stories about lecherous bosses who feel they have complete impunity to behave that way. Others have been raped by colleagues. You can check out the site reporttheabuse.org to get a sense of these stories. That's at https://reporttheabuse.org. Jessica says dealing with sexual harassment is trickier than it might be if you were in your home country. For one thing, the local culture could be very male-centric.
And it's, of course, further complicated by the fact that you're working with people from so many different cultures than your own. I mean, not just the people in the country that you're working with, but also the expats come from all over the world. You know, it's not like all of the international aid workers are European. You get a lot of expats from other countries who also may have very different perceptions and understandings of gender or dating and what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. So I think you also have to fit into that to a certain extent, because you have to be culturally sensitive to your colleagues also as well. But that kind of complicates the issue.
Because what's normal male to female behaviour to some is insulting to others. And the environment they all work in can exacerbate this stuff.
I do think, in general, there is kind of a culture of machoness within the sector caused by people kind of being very stressed and being like, well, we're in this kind of disaster zone, like all bets are off. So that can make it difficult. And also because you're in a place where you're entirely dependent on your organisation in a lot of places. There is no active local police force or government that would have the capacity or have the laws to protect you that you might expect in your own country. So you're entirely dependent on your organisation for that kind of support.
And that support doesn't always come. She says at least the topic's now being discussed more openly in the aid community. It's a start.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
On to a more minor difficulty. I did a whole show last year on menstruation at work and society's attitudes to women's bodily functions. Jessica says, you think it's bad having a period at your office? Try the delights of menstruating in a remote area. Local women have no access to tampons or pads, so neither do you.
In terms of sanitary equipment, you definitely have to kind of bring all your own stuff. So if you're packing for three months or 6 months, or you don't know how long, then you have to bring all that with you. You often also have squat toilets, and often they're like not particularly clean, because you just can't be clean within that situation when you have a squat toilet that's, you know, there's no concrete walls, it's made of grass or maybe plastic sheeting, then obviously you are going to get flies and lizards and everything like that around. In some places, of course, it's difficult to buy toilet paper. That is obviously something that people try to provide, because culturally it's difficult for some people not to have that around. But I mean, it's also something that, especially if you're kind of traveling around meeting other people, you just kind of get used to. And yeah, you know, having periods is difficult. And I have had the situation once where I drove 2.5 hours to a field location, went to the loo, realised I had my period. Literally, my only option was to drive 2.5 hours back the other way, because I guess I could have asked the woman there who lived there, but unfortunately, the reality for a lot of the women in the world is that they use grass or bits of old cloth, and that's something that I feel very bad that they have to do. But it's not something that I think I could deal with myself. But that was very kind of awkward, having to just tell the driver, like, I have to go back now. Like, I cannot stay here for the rest of the day as planned. And after that, I learned to, you know, always be prepared, because it's not like in countries where I'm used to, where there's always some kind of solution.
That made me think about just how different her work life is from most of her friends back home. She says she has a good, close group of friends, particularly women friends, but talking about work can feel weird.
how can you really explain to somebody what it's like to work surrounded by 70,000 refugees, or to, you know, be in a position where you see people without enough food, or everyone around you is absolutely desperate and has had to leave their homes and has lost relatives? And it's quite an overwhelming experience that does change you, and I'm sure that's the same for, you know, other contexts as well. Within the sector, you always kind of make jokes about it, well, about funny things that happened, and I think that's kind of a coping mechanism. But within normal people conversation, well, normal to, you know, the kind of people that I grew up amongst, it can seem that you're bringing in all these giant serious things to the conversation that they wouldn't necessarily normally think about, except for kind of half an hour watching the news and go, oh, that's terrible, and then turn it off. So it can feel that you're bringing an uncomfortable subject into kind of a very comfortable position. And it does also feel that other people will struggle to understand that aspect of you.
She says it's totally different with other aid workers. They get it. Still, despite the difficulties and discomfort that can come with the job, she says she's learned so much.
It does expose you to different ways of being a woman. You get exposed to all these different cultures where femininity, or what that means, is expressed very differently, and you have to go into that and act as a woman, in many cases act as a manager in situations or cultures where that's really very rare or completely unheard of for the people living there. What do you do if you're a manager for a group of 20 people who you've tried to hire as many women as you could, but very few women applied for the positions because there's cultural barrier against that? So the majority of them are men, with maybe a couple of younger women who aren't yet married. And none of these men have ever been in a position where they have a woman in a position of authority over them. And you have to kind of navigate that. And I think it's kind of a fine line between, you don't want to be the random foreigner who's just coming in and bossing people about and being horrible and not, you know, not sensitive to the nuances of the situation. But also, you don't want to be a pushover. So that's kind of an interesting dynamic.
She says she has had criticism from local staff, and she thinks of it as part of the job. She says navigating those social relationships is a challenge, but it's one she likes. And she didn't articulate this, but I will. She's a young white woman, often managing people of a different race, which surely adds to that dynamic. She says the local staff, they're working in their own country, and that country's undergone a disaster, so they're stressed out, just like the people they're all trying to help. Jessica says you have to handle each situation with sensitivity, particularly if you're female.
Some people do it without much sensitivity, but just get respected for being leaders or for being macho. So I think some men in the sector play up to that macho-ness that might be found more in that area or that country. That's how then they kind of act as a leader. But as a woman, you have to go in and, you know, create your own way to try and get the work done and to solve interpersonal conflicts between your staff members, which may have strange and difficult cultural aspects that are quite alien to you, while being an effective manager. I once had to deal with two male staff, one of whom was accusing the other of threatening to kill him using witchcraft, which obviously I personally don't believe in, but I have to take it seriously and not disregard that person's feelings and fears, and also be aware that normally they probably wouldn't be going to a woman who's younger than them to resolve a dispute between them. So in that case, I tried to facilitate some kind of dialogue between the two, and then said that in the end, that was probably something that they needed to discuss amongst their families and in the community. But that's just one example. There's a lot of other examples. I had one issue where some male staff were accusing a female staff member of basically of having premarital sex, which was difficult because obviously that's something that I and all of my friends do and don't think is wrong. But it's not really my place to say, to just say that and say that they're being stupid without acknowledging the fact that that accusation within their world has a very different meaning to what it does to me.
On the one hand, she wanted to be a feminist and tell these guys to stop slut-shaming. On the other hand, she knew that would backfire. Again, she says she had to try to respect the local culture. So she told the men there should be a distinction between work life and private life, that it wasn't appropriate to bring stuff about this woman's private life into the workplace unless it affected the work. She says to this day, she doesn't know if she handled it the right way. And she says, after all, these are only her experiences. She's a highly educated woman from the West. Women from different backgrounds will have other experiences. She's grateful to have lived and worked with some of them. She says it's one of the best things about the job.
In what other sector would I spend 5 months living literally in the same room as a Kenyan woman in her 40s or 50s and trying to sneak in a bit drunk on Saturday nights? But, you know, also seeing her and her missing her children back in Kenya, but feeling that this opportunity was a good one for her professionally. I don't think there's any other sector where I could have that experience of being so close to so many people, but also so many women of different ages and different cultures to me.
Jessica is still considering her next career move, and I'm setting up an interview with her Kenyan roommate to hear her side of the Women in AIDS story. That's the broad experience for this time. If you think stories like these are important, please consider kicking in with a donation. You can do that at thebroadexperience.com/support. If you donate $50, you will receive the official Broad Experience t-shirt. You can see a photo of that on the website. And thanks again to all those of you who've already supported the show or support it on a monthly basis. If you can't donate, write a review on iTunes instead. It's free and it only takes a couple of minutes. You can send me feedback via the website or leave a comment there or on the show's Facebook page. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite. Thanks for listening.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.